So thank you very much, everyone. We've got quite an amazing opportunity today. This is actually a first for the conference, despite the conference now being in its 51st iteration, its 51st year. So I'm very pleased to welcome Lord Jones to the faculty to give a talk today on the role of the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom and the Privy Council, where it sits in our legal system in a more general sense. Please, I think JJ's already told you this, no photos during the talk. You will have an opportunity to ask questions after. But apart from that, I'll hand over to Lord Jones. So please, everyone, a massive round of applause.
Well, thank you, Jake, for your very kind introduction. I don't think I've ever addressed such a packed lecture theatre, but I must warn you that no lecture theatre is so large that I cannot empty it. It's a great pleasure to be asked to speak to you this afternoon. I hope you're enjoying the conference and finding it useful and informative as you make your plans for the future. I'm going to say something about the work of two courts, both of which sit in the same building in Parliament Square in London, and both of which are staffed by the same judges. One is the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom, which is the final court of appeal for all jurisdictions in the United Kingdom. That is for Scotland, for Northern Ireland, and for England and Wales. England and Wales are bundled together because Wales, I'm a Welshman by the way, Wales does not have a separate jurisdiction. Since 1536, England and Wales have been one shared jurisdiction. That's one court, the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom. The other is the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council, which is still the final court of appeal for 29 overseas jurisdictions in the Commonwealth. I'm going to spend most of the time speaking about the Supreme Court, but if there's time at the end, I'll say something about the Privy Council. The Supreme Court of the United Kingdom is a relatively new institution. It was created by the Constitutional Reform Act of 2005, and it sat for the first time in October 2009. Before that, the highest court of appeal in the United Kingdom was a committee of the House of Lords, the Appellate Committee of the House of Lords. And the judges who sat there were members of the House of Lords, and they were known as the Lords of Appeal in Ordinary, and they were known informally as the Law Lords. Now, the creation of the Supreme Court by the Constitutional Reform Act in 2005 marked a significant constitutional development. Previously, the highest court in the judicial branch of government had been a committee of the House of Lords, had been a committee of the legislative branch of government. And the thinking behind the reform was to achieve a greater degree of separation of powers between the different branches of government, the executive, the legislature, and the judiciary. However, it did not change the substance of the court's jurisdiction. The cases that we hear, in essence, are the same sort of cases which were previously heard by the Appellate Committee of the House of Lords. There was a change in titles and in status. The former law lords were life peers. They were members of the House of Lords for life. Today, justices of the Supreme Court are not, by virtue of their judicial office, life peers, with the exception of our president, currently Lord Reed. But as long as the president is a serving judge, then the president's not allowed to sit in the House of Lords. The justices of the Supreme Court do, however, have the courtesy title of Lord or Lady, and there are 12 justices of the Supreme Court, of whom I'm one, and of whom, at the moment, two members are women. The reform made visible what had long been a constitutional convention, that is, that the judges are independent of Parliament. By establishing the Supreme Court in its own building, with its own staff and identity, the separation of powers became more apparent and more transparent. the House of Lords, as an appeal court, used to sit in a committee room in the committee corridor of the Palace of Westminster. The public were admitted, but it was difficult to gain access, and very few did. When the Supreme Court was created, it moved across Parliament Square into the refurbished Middlesex Guildhall, a historic building opposite the Palace of Westminster. The move was modest in geographic terms, only a few hundred yards, but it was significant in constitutional symbolism. It reinforced the independence of the judiciary, and it improved accessibility and transparency. The Supreme Court was designed as a modern and public court. The building is open to the public free of charge. Last year, 2025, we had 81,000 visitors. The courtroom is usually busy with school students, university students, and other visitors, as well as the parties to the cases and their lawyers. Hearings usually last a day, depending on the complexity of the case, but visitors come and go. I should say not many last all day. Most last about 10 minutes of legal argument. But some of them do stay. Some of them, in fact, stay all day and listen to the entire argument in the case. In addition, hearings are live streamed on the internet and recordings are available on the Supreme Court website. So if you can get to London, you will be very welcome to visit us. And if not, you can enjoy watching a live hearing or a recording of a hearing online. Although the Supreme Court is based in its permanent home in Middlesex Guildhall in Parliament Square, from time to time it holds hearings in other parts of the United Kingdom as part of its commitment to accessibility and public engagement. And in recent years, the court has sat in the other capital cities of the United Kingdom, in Belfast, Edinburgh, and Cardiff. It sat in Manchester, and next month we're going to be sitting in Glasgow. Now, these sittings allow members of the public outside London to observe the court at work. And this also reflects the fact that the Supreme Court serves the whole of the United Kingdom. It is a UK court. It serves England and Wales, Scotland, and Northern Ireland. And sitting, therefore, in different parts of the country is a practical and symbolic reminder that the court is a national institution, not simply a London one. So let's take a closer look inside the Supreme Court. What sort of cases reach the Supreme Court? How do they find their way there? Now, the Supreme Court is not a court to which one has an automatic right of appeal. It hears only a limited number of cases each year, those that raise arguable points of law of general public importance. Those words are important. Arguable points of law of general public importance. We're not concerned with, well, not concerned solely with whether the lower courts simply got it wrong or whether they got it right. Rather, we ask whether the case raises a legal issue that matters beyond the particular dispute in hand, an issue of wider significance which will affect the development of the law, guide future conduct, or help to clarify the law in an important area. As a result, we hear relatively few appeals. We hear about 50 appeals a year in the Supreme Court and about the same number in the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council. In most instances, litigants must obtain permission to appeal either from the Court of Appeal or from the Supreme Court itself before they can bring an appeal to the Supreme Court. Applications for permission to appeal are decided by panels of three justices, and in almost all cases, we decide the applications on the basis of written arguments without an oral hearing. The permission stage acts as a filter. It ensures that the court's time is devoted to cases that genuinely require resolution at the highest level. Now, to understand why that's the case, I have to say something about the structure of our courts and something about the nature of the common law. Taking England and Wales as an example, then, at the base of the system are the trial courts. In criminal cases, that means magistrates' courts, or the Crown Court. And in civil matters, it'll be the High Court or the County Court. Trial courts decide disputes by hearing evidence. Witnesses give oral testimony. Documents are examined. In criminal trials in the Crown Court, juries will be involved. The judge or the jury, if there is one, make findings of fact. What happened? Who did what? What is proved? In broad terms, above them sits the Court of Appeal. And the role of the Court of Appeal is different. It does not conduct a fresh trial. It reviews the decision of the lower court to determine whether there's been an error of law or a serious procedural irregularity. And it may, in defined circumstances, interfere with findings of fact, but it does so very cautiously, recognizing that the trial judge is best placed to make findings of fact because the trial judge will have heard and seen the witnesses giving their evidence. An appeal is not a second chance to run a case differently. It's an opportunity to show that the law has been applied incorrectly or that the proceedings were seriously flawed due to some procedural or other irregularity. In the Court of Appeal, most appeals are heard by three Lord Justices or Lady Justices. From the Court of Appeal, a case may go on appeal to the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court is the second tier of appeal. And our role is narrower still. We don't hear witnesses, and we don't hear cross-examination. We don't retry cases. Instead, we determine questions of law, and they're usually novel and difficult questions of law. So when a case reaches the Supreme Court, it's already traveled a considerable distance. The facts have been established, the issues have been refined. What remains is the question of law that matters, and a question of law that matters not just to the parties, but also to society as a whole. We come back to the words, a point of law of general public importance. Our decisions have an importance beyond the particular dispute before the court. And a vital feature of the common law is that decisions of appellate courts are binding as law on courts beneath them in the hierarchy of courts. So when we decide a case in the Supreme Court, we don't simply decide the dispute before us. What we decide lays down a rule of law for the future, which has to be followed by other courts. And in this way, the common law has developed over almost 1,000 years with rules of law and legal principles emerging from patterns of decided cases. How does the Supreme Court work? Well, we generally hear appeals in panels of at least 5 justices. However, the court sometimes sits in larger panels of 7 or 9 justices in cases of particular importance. If we're asked to depart from an earlier decision of the Supreme Court or the House of Lords, we would normally sit as 7 justices because we'd be departing from a decision of 5 justices or 5 law lords in the earlier case. We all receive the papers in an appeal about 10 days before the hearing. And at a minimum, we will be expected to have read in advance of the hearing the written cases of the parties, that is, the documents setting out the legal arguments, which usually are limited to 50 pages. We'll have read the judgments in the courts below. We'll have read the main documents in the case and the principal authorities, that is, the principal decided cases that have a bearing on what we have to decide. The judges sitting on the case, we'll all meet the morning of the hearing 15 minutes before we go into court, and that meeting is useful to exchange preliminary views and to identify the areas of the case which we think are the most important. So one of us might say, I think the real point in this case is X, or another might say, I really want to hear what the appellant or the respondent has to say about point Y. The Supreme Court always hands down reserved judgment. A reserved judgment is where a judge does not give an immediate ruling at the conclusion of the hearing. Instead, the judge postpones the ruling to allow for careful deliberation and writing of a reserved judgment. The judge takes additional time to analyze the legal argument and to conduct research on complex or novel legal issues before issuing a final decision in a written, reasoned judgment. And writing judgments is an important part of our work as justices of the Supreme Court, and it is, of course, very time-consuming. In the Supreme Court, immediately after the conclusion of the hearing, we will hold a second meeting at which only the justices are in the room. The five justices have sat on the case, and each justice in turn will provide an oral summary of his or her view of the outcome of the case. This process always starts with the most junior member of the court and then proceeds upwards in order of seniority until all five of us have spoken. One of my colleagues used to refer to this as a penalty shootout. For new members of the court, it can be quite a nerve-wracking experience, believe me, although one can grow to enjoy it. One can grow to enjoy having a captive audience. Once every member of the court has spoken, it will have become apparent whether there is unanimity or a majority for a particular view. And when we're not all agreed, the judges in the minority will write a dissenting judgment. Even though dissents are not discouraged, the statistics show a remarkable level of consensus within the Supreme Court, bearing in mind that the court deals exclusively with the most complex and difficult cases on which views may legitimately differ. Last year, 92% of our decisions in the Supreme Court were unanimous. No dissent, unanimous decision. All the justices agreed. It's only at the end of the deliberation that a decision is taken as to who is going to write a judgment. And usually there will be a lead judgment written by one member of the court, and that will be circulated before other members of the court write concurring judgments or dissenting judgments. Sometimes a dissenting judgment may be circulated first in an attempt to win over any waverers that there might be in the court. The process of deliberation continues, usually by email, often over an extended period, until the judgment or the judgments are ready. It's all very collegiate. It's often the case that the circulation of a draft dissenting judgment results in a tightening and an improvement of the reasoning in the majority judgment. Sometimes a draft dissenting judgment can cause a change of mind on the part of one or more of the other members of the court. And occasionally, what starts as a dissenting judgment may become a majority judgment or even the sole judgment in a unanimous decision as justices change their minds. Now, the freedom of a judge to dissent from the view favored by colleagues and to publish a dissenting judgment is a matter of fundamental importance. This freedom to dissent, which we consider entirely normal in common law jurisdictions, enables each judge in deciding the particular case to act in accordance with his or her conscience and the judicial oath or affirmation that we've all taken. Within the deliberating court, it can perform the valuable function of testing the reasoning of the majority. And freedom to dissent has a wider significance in common law systems, extending beyond the decision in the particular case. Each decided case forms a part of a pattern as the common law in a particular field develops. Dissenting judgments can play an important role in identifying the shifting points in the development of the law. Where the majority are developing the law in a new direction, one often encounters a dissenting judgment urging restraint, expressing misgivings, or protesting against the departure from orthodoxy. Conversely, there are striking examples of dissenting judgments which advocate bold developments in the law which have not found favor with the majority, but which are forward-looking and which, as it happens, later play an influential role in the subsequent development of the law. So a dissenting judge may be ahead of his or her time. The importance and value of the freedom to deliver a dissenting judgment is apparent from the judgments of those courts where it's not permitted. In the Court of Justice of the European Union in Luxembourg, for example, the requirement is that all of the judges sitting on a case must agree to a single judgment. No doubt this is done in the interests of clarity and certainty, but it does have a regrettable effect on the quality of the resulting decisions. One ends up with the bare minimum to which all the judges are prepared to agree, and the result is often difficult to understand. By contrast, the freedom of judges in the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, where they have the freedom to deliver separate or dissenting judgments, has resulted in a greater intellectual rigor, which has much enhanced the reputation of that court. More generally, it seems to me that to permit dissenting judgments on appeals is both desirable and necessary once one recognizes that there's not always a single right answer to a legal problem, that judges do make law to a greater or lesser extent, that judges are fallible, just like everyone else, and that as a result, there's often room for differing views as to the law and the way in which it should develop. Transparency of decision-making requires that different views should not be internalized and concealed, but that they should be exposed to the daylight of public scrutiny. It seems to me that the essence of the law is debate and the legitimate expression of different opinions as part of the process of arriving at a just conclusion, and that the public are entitled to the evidence of dissenting judgments as an assurance that judges are actually doing their conscientious best to do justice according to the law. Now, what about the constitutional role of the Supreme Court? The Supreme Court is not a constitutional court. It does not have the power to declare that primary legislation, that is an act of Parliament, of the Westminster Parliament, is invalid and unenforceable. That's because of the principle of parliamentary sovereignty. This principle forms part of the United Kingdom's unwritten constitution, and it means that Parliament is the supreme legal authority. Parliament can make any law, and no court can strike down an act of Parliament. By contrast, in some countries, in Germany and Italy, for example, there are special constitutional courts with the power to declare legislation unconstitutional if it's incompatible with the written constitution, thus rendering it ineffective. The United Kingdom's membership of the European Union presented a significant departure from the constitutional role of the court. The principle of the supremacy of EU law was not entirely easy to reconcile with the traditional doctrine of parliamentary sovereignty. In a case called Factotum, the House of Lords disapplied an act of Parliament to the extent that it was incompatible with EU law. And in that case, Lord Bridge explained that any limitation on parliamentary sovereignty was entirely voluntary because Parliament had chosen to give effect to the supremacy of EU law by enacting the European Communities Act of 1972. Following Brexit, the principle of the supremacy of EU law is no longer part of our domestic law, and the Supreme Court therefore no longer has the power to disapply legislation on the grounds of conflict with EU law, save in limited circumstances under the withdrawal arrangement. The Supreme Court does, however, still perform significant constitutional functions, and many of the most important questions about the limits of executive power and the protection of fundamental rights ultimately come before the Supreme Court. One area in which this is particularly clear is devolution, where there is a special system of constitutional references to the Supreme Court to enable the Supreme Court to rule on whether the legislative bodies in Scotland, Northern Ireland, and Wales are acting within the powers delegated to them by the Scotland Act, the Northern Ireland Act, and the Government of Wales Act. The Human Rights Act, again, gives legal effect to the European Convention on Human Rights in lots of different ways. Section 2 obliges judges to take into account judgments of the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg when deciding a case that raises questions concerning human rights. Courts in this country are not strictly bound by the case law of the European Court of Human Rights, but they usually follow clear and consistent principles developed by that court. Section 3 of the Human Rights Act requires judges to interpret all domestic legislation in a way that is compatible with human rights so far as that is possible. And this is a strong interpretive duty that allows courts to adopt meanings or imply words as long as it doesn't undermine the law's purpose. So in one case, for example, the House of Lords interpreted the Rent Act of 1997 to extend tenancy rights to same-sex partners. Without striking down any act of Parliament, the courts were able to protect human rights with similar force by way of interpretation. Courts, however, cannot rewrite legislation, and if a court cannot interpret legislation compatibly with convention rights, then it may issue a declaration of incompatibility under Section 4 of the Human Rights Act. That does not invalidate the Act of Parliament, and it therefore preserves the principle of parliamentary sovereignty. But it does signal that the law is inconsistent with convention rights, and Parliament usually responds by amending the law, but it's not legally required to do so. So a lot of cases that come before the Supreme Court require the justices to take into account the European Convention on Human Rights. And in 2023, for example, the Supreme Court decided that the last government's Rwanda policy was unlawful. The court ultimately concluded that there were substantial grounds for believing that asylum seekers sent to Rwanda would face a real risk of refoulement, that is, in other words, being returned to countries where they might face persecution, and therefore that the policy was unlawful. In particular, in addition to breaching other treaties, the policy breached the right to freedom from torture and inhuman or degrading treatment under Article 3 of the European Convention on Human Rights. So this case is an example of the Supreme Court engaging with questions of fundamental rights and the legal limits of governmental policy. A third area in which the court performs an important constitutional function is in defining the limits of executive power. One of the most striking examples arose during the United Kingdom's withdrawal from the European Union. In the first Miller case, the government sought to use its prerogative powers, that is, the powers derived historically from royal authority exercised by the monarch, today exercised by the executive branch of government, to trigger the formal legal process of leaving the European Union. And the court held that it could not do so without authorization from Parliament, because leaving the European Union would fundamentally alter domestic law and remove rights which had been incorporated into domestic law from EU law. A later case, Miller number 2, concerned the lawfulness of prorogation, that is, the suspension of Parliament for 5 weeks during the Brexit negotiations. The Supreme Court held that the prorogation was unlawful because it had the effect of frustrating Parliament's ability to carry out its constitutional functions without reasonable justification. And in this way, the Supreme Court's decision defended Parliament against the unlawful exercise of power by the executive. I said earlier that the court sometimes sits in a larger panel of 7 or 9 justices. In the 2 Miller cases, exceptionally, the court sat as a panel of 11 justices. We're required to sit as an odd number. There are 12 justices. We're required to sit as an odd number in case there's disagreement, so there'll always be a majority. We sat as 11 because those 2 cases raised questions of such constitutional importance. And those are the only 2 cases where we've sat as 11 justices. The Miller cases illustrate an important point. The Supreme Court does not involve itself in political debates or policy choices. These are matters for Parliament and for the elected government. But when legal questions arise about the boundaries of governmental power, who has the authority to do what and under what legal constraints, then it falls to the courts to provide an answer. But the Supreme Court is not confined to constitutional questions. It's the final court of appeal in all civil cases in the UK and in all criminal cases from England, Wales, and Northern Ireland. The Supreme Court of the United Kingdom remains formally and structurally a court of general jurisdiction at the apex of the appellate hierarchy, not a special constitutional court standing apart from it. The cases which come before us raise many legal questions across many different areas, including criminal law, commercial law, employment law, patents and trademarks and intellectual property, environmental law, taxation and family law, amongst others. Let me turn to say something a little more briefly, I hope, about the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council. That's the other court which sits in our building, which is staffed by the same justices. And the justices of the Supreme Court also sit as the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council, usually referred to simply as the Privy Council. It's a most unusual court which has just been left over from the British Empire. For a remarkable number of people around the world, the final court of appeal is still this court sitting in London, the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council. The Judicial Committee was established in 1833 as the highest court of civil and criminal appeal for the British Empire. And under the Appellate Jurisdiction Act of 1876, the law lords became permanent judges of the Privy Council. At its height, it was a global court. Appeals came from countries including Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and India. At its zenith, a quarter of the world's population lived under legal systems whose final court of appeal was the Privy Council. For much of its history, the Privy Council Court sat in the most unlikely place, number 9 Downing Street in Westminster. When the Supreme Court was created, the Privy Council moved to the Supreme Court building where there's a separate courtroom for Privy Council appeals. The old Privy Council courtroom in Downing Street has now been converted into a room for press conferences. You will have seen it on the news bulletins on the TV. It's where the Prime Minister speaks when he holds a press conference. It's changed beyond recognition. I was there a couple of years ago. I noticed that there are still two sets of doors into the room, however. One is marked appellants and the other is marked respondents. That's the only thing that's left over, I think, from the days when it was a courtroom. With the decline of the British Empire, many member countries chose to maintain a right of appeal to the Privy Council by agreement with the United Kingdom. Countries such as Canada, India, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand gradually chose to establish their own final courts of appeal and to end appeals to the Privy Council. The last of them, of those, was New Zealand, which ended appeals to the Privy Council as recently as 2003. But today, the Privy Council remains a final court of appeal for 29 overseas jurisdictions. These include independent states, such as Trinidad and Tobago, Jamaica, Mauritius, British overseas territories, such as the Cayman Islands and Bermuda, and Crown dependencies, such as Jersey and Guernsey and the Isle of Man. And the jurisdiction of the Privy Council continues to evolve. In 2023, the Parliament of St. Lucia abolished the right of appeal to the Privy Council and replaced us with the Caribbean Court of Justice. The smallest jurisdiction is the Pitcairn Islands in the South Pacific, which has in the entire territory only 60 inhabitants, most of whom are descendants of the mutineers of HMS Bounty, and most of whom are called Christian, after Fletcher Christian, are descendants of Fletcher Christian. While most panels in the Privy Council are composed of justices of the Supreme Court, we can and do sit with judges from the jurisdictions whose cases we hear. And recently I've been sitting with Dame Janice Pereira, former Chief Justice of the Eastern Caribbean Supreme Court, and Sir Anthony Smellie, who was the Chief Justice of Cayman Islands. They're both judges of the Privy Council. Now, this has real importance as their direct experience of local conditions enhances the quality and the legitimacy of Privy Council decision making. Privy Council applies the local law of the jurisdiction from which the appeal comes. In many cases, that law is based on the English common law. And that's why there's often a shared legal language across many Privy Council jurisdictions, and decisions of the Privy Council can have a unifying influence in the common law. But the local legal system is not always a common law system. Take Mauritius, for example. Its legal system is primarily based on the civil law, that is, ultimately based on the old Roman law, civil law system, very much influenced by the French Napoleonic Code. So when we sit hearing an appeal from Mauritius, we often have in front of us copies of the Mauritius edition of French law textbooks. And we have to do our best with our schoolboy or schoolgirl French to understand the texts. An unusual feature of the Privy Council is that, unlike the Supreme Court, we don't formally give judgments in our own name. Instead, we advise His Majesty the King. Historically, this reflects the fact that the Privy Council performs the function of the monarch's advisory body. So when we hear an appeal, we deliberate just as any court would, but the decision is then expressed as advice to the sovereign, which is almost always followed and becomes the effective judgment in the case. So we don't strictly decide cases, we advise the sovereign on how they should be decided. There is, however, an important exception. In appeals from a republic, such as Trinidad and Tobago or Mauritius, the position's different. There, we're not advising the monarch as head of state because the monarch has no constitutional role in those countries other than head of the Commonwealth. Instead, the Privy Council acts as the final court of appeal in its own right. Until 1966, it was the practice of the Privy Council to deliver only one judgment. That reflected the fact that the Privy Council was advising Her Majesty, as it then was, on the questions referred, and that only a single opinion was appropriate. But today, the practice of the Privy Council in relation to dissenting judgments varies very little from that of the Supreme Court. A single opinion with which the other members of the committee agree is standard, but joint opinions, separate opinions, and dissenting opinions are not infrequent. We decide about 50 cases a year in the Privy Council. Privy Council can hear every type of case, civil, criminal, constitutional, or international. In many cases that reach the Privy Council, the appellant has an automatic right of appeal. This means, unlike in appeals to the Supreme Court, that the appellant does not need to obtain permission from the Privy Council. Each jurisdiction has its own rules, but often an appeal as of right exists where a case has a minimum monetary value or involves questions as to the interpretation of the Constitution. This means that very ordinary cases, which do not raise a point of general public importance, are often heard in the Privy Council. For example, we could hear an appeal arising from a private land dispute between neighbours in Jamaica, and often do. Privy Council operates across many different constitutional systems. Many jurisdictions, such as Jamaica or Trinidad and Tobago, have written codified constitutions. And in those jurisdictions, the constitution is the supreme law, which includes fundamental rights protection. This means that courts, including the Privy Council, can strike down legislation that conflicts with the Constitution. Unlike the Supreme Court, which cannot strike down legislation for the reasons I've already explained, the Privy Council, when hearing appeals from jurisdictions with written constitutions, may invalidate laws which are inconsistent with those constitutions. In those cases where the appellant must apply directly to the Privy Council for permission to appeal, Privy Council applies its own test. In civil cases, the test is the same as permission to appeal to the Supreme Court. Permission is granted in applications that raise an arguable point of law of general public importance. In criminal cases, permission is granted where there's a risk that a serious miscarriage of justice has occurred. Many criminal cases in the Privy Council come from jurisdictions that have the death penalty, although mercifully, in none of them is it now carried out. One such case is Farrington and the King, a case from the Bahamas. In 1992, Mr. Farrington was convicted of murder and sentenced to death. In 1996, the Privy Council considered that a delay of 3 years and 4 months in carrying out the execution contravened his constitutional right to protection from inhuman and degrading treatment. The Privy Council advised that a life sentence be substituted for the death sentence. However, the Privy Council did not give Mr. Farrington an opportunity to make representations as to the appropriate substitute sentence. The case came back to the Privy Council for a second time some 28 years later. Mr. Farrington argued that this was a serious breach of procedural fairness, that he'd not been given an opportunity to make representations as to the appropriate substitute sentence. And in 2025, the Privy Council agreed with him. It decided that he'd not been given an opportunity to be heard and that the life sentence should be quashed. The Privy Council ordered that the resentencing should be remitted to the Supreme Court of the Bahamas. Today, many hearings take place by video link. So the justices are sitting in the courtroom in Parliament Square in London. Counsel and the parties appear on screens from Jamaica or Bahamas or Bermuda or Mauritius or wherever. We have to adjust the time. We have to adjust the time in order to take account of this. One of our jurisdictions is the Cook Islands in the South Pacific. And on one occasion, counsel, two lots of counsel, one lot of counsel were sitting in the Cook Islands, which is 11 hours behind London time, and the others were sitting in Auckland in New Zealand, which is 11 hours ahead of London time. So we actually sat at 6 o'clock in the evening in order to accommodate the needs of counsel in that particular case. This allows litigants, doing it online in this way, it allows litigants to participate without incurring the cost of traveling to London. And it also makes it easier for local lawyers to argue cases. And although it's based in London, the Privy Council has on occasion sat overseas. It sat in the Bahamas, it sat in Mauritius, and it sat in the Cayman Islands. I sat with them in Cayman Islands 3 years ago. Now, these visits are undertaken to improve access to justice and to strengthen the relationship between the court and the jurisdiction that it serves. I might add that whenever such a sitting is proposed, there's never any shortage of volunteers amongst the justices to go and sit there. Let me finish by saying that I hope you are enjoying exploring the law. I hope you're enjoying this conference and finding it valuable. And I hope that some of you might be persuaded to read law at university and to become lawyers. I've been lucky enough to have a number of different lives in the law, and I promise you that it can be very rewarding in all sorts of ways and enormous fun. You are all clearly high flyers, I can say that, because you've been selected to attend this conference. And I'm confident that you all have great careers in front of you. Some of you, I have no doubt, will in time go on to achieve high judicial office. Some of you, I am confident, will one day sit in the Supreme Court and in the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council. But whatever paths you decide to follow, I wish you all the luck in the world. Thank you very much.